Hansen, and I am one of the pastors here on staff, and I'm the team leader for our student ministries department. And I tell you, as a youth pastor, you want to get my heart going? You want to get my heart stirring? This is it. Seeing kids who have given their lives to Jesus, seeing kids who are being baptized and following Christ in obedience, it just doesn't get any better than this. And this weekend has been a blessing, and I'm so glad that all of you can share in our excitement and our joy and celebrate with us. I want to start by asking one question to you, and you don't have to yell at answers to this, just do it in your mind, but I want to ask you, what is the first word that comes to mind when you hear the word adolescent? Yeah, some of you are giggling, right? Because you're not sure. Some of them are going to be good. Some of them are going to be positive. Some maybe not so. You know, depending on your experience as a teen, your experience with teens, your perceptions from teens, from our modern culture, you'll have many different answers. You know, I believe that teenagers have gotten a bad rap over the years for a long time. And to illustrate my point, I've got a couple quotes from some scholars that I want to share with you. The first one is from Mark Twain from the 19th century. His views on adolescence. Here it goes. When a child turns 12, you should put him in a barrel. All right, you can see the direction already, right? Nail the lid down and feed him through a knot hole. When he turns 16, plug the hole. That's his take on adolescence, and that was from good old Mark Twain. How about this one from another scholar? Our youth now love luxury. They have bad manners, contempt for authority. They show disrespect for their elders and love chatter in place of exercise. They no longer rise when elders enter the room. They contradict their parents, chatter before company, gobble up their food, and tyrannize their teachers. And that was written by the Greek philosopher Socrates in 400 BC. You know, I don't feel that way about teenagers. I actually view them very differently. I believe that children and teenagers are our most precious resource, brimming with unlimited potential and excitement. And I would dare to say that God sees them the same way. As you look through Scripture, there's multiple places, and just a few of them. You know, King Josiah was 8 years old when he brought back the word of the Lord to Israel. You know, when King David slew Goliath, he was an adolescent. Mary, the mother of Jesus, was most likely an adolescent when she gave birth to Jesus. And if you're a teenager here today, you need to hear me say to you clearly that you are never too young to do great things for God. And that is true. You're never too young. A young life is given to God is a powerful life, full of potential. You know, that's not to say that adolescence isn't without its struggles or its difficulties. It's known as a time of storm and stress. In fact, the adolescence that I knew and that most of you knew have known has changed over the last number of years. In 1904, a guy named G. Stanley Hall coined the phrase adolescence in his book. And I'll tell you, this is a million-dollar title right here. The title of his book is Adolescence, Its Psychology and Its Relation to Physiology, Anthropology, Sociology, Sex, Crime, Religion, and Education, Volumes 1 and 2. It's a big book. You can get it if you want, a couple volumes. But originally, the transition from childhood to adulthood was only 18 months. That's just a year and a half. But as time went on, the adolescent time continuum also changed. And now, or actually in the 1950s and 1970s, it was about 5 years long, about the high school years. Now, if you talk to researchers currently, in the last number of years, they've been talking about adolescence and doing lots of studies. They're saying this, that the adolescent timeline is now 15 years and it spans the ages of 10 to 25 plus. It's a process that starts with puberty and is starting younger and younger, and it ends with our culture saying that you finally arrived into adulthood, which is becoming later and later. You have to picture it like two rivers, two big bodies of water connected by one river. Each body of water, one being childhood, one being adulthood, and it's this river that everyone must traverse and everyone has to go through. The difference today is that the journey is starting significantly earlier, and it's grown much longer with greater undulations, faster moving currents, and more turbulence than adults today ever experienced before. You know, and as a parent, there can be a lot of fear and trepidation around raising preteens and teenagers, but don't worry. Don't worry, because adolescence, it's freaking out your kids as well. It's known as a time of transition, a great time of change. For instance, they're changing one thing, they're changing mentally from concrete thinking to abstract thinking. A great illustration of this is a student that I picked up one day after school, a young early teen. After having a Coke with him and talking with him, it's time to drive him home. I said, "Do you know how to get home?" "Oh yeah, no problem." So I started driving home. He started pointing me the way, and it didn't take long until I kind of felt, where are we going? This is turning here, we're going around here. We ended up in a place that actually, if we would just would have gone down this road straight and made one turn over here, you know, we would have ended up at his house. And I didn't know what was going on. And finally it dawned on me as I was driving home, this kid is a concrete thinker. He took me home the only way he knew how, the bus route. Yeah, we followed the bus route the whole way around until we got to where he knew where he was, because that's all he knew. That was a concrete thinker. But now students, as they develop and change, they can start to think abstractly, think outside of the box. And as a student ministries department, as parents, we can introduce them to a new way of looking at God. And that is exciting stuff. What about physically they're changing? If you come down to our junior high world, we'll have kids who are not yet 5 feet and other kids who are 6'3" in the same grade. And their bodies are just going like crazy and changing it rapidly at different rates. Socially, they're changing. Their friend base from elementary school is very neighborhood focused. They can start going to high schools. They spread out a little more. They start playing on different sports teams or rep teams. They start stretching more. And, you know, they might start having friends who live in places like Langley or Surrey or Abbotsford or what about Chilliwack? You know, they start having friends. Their friend base starts to stretch. That's a big change. Emotionally, they go from being dependent to trying to be independent. And parents, if you haven't heard this already, you will, and you hear it a lot of different times. I'm not a kid anymore, right? I'm an adult now. Or don't treat me like a kid. Those kinds of conversations. That's emotionally what happens. They're not a kid anymore. They talk about that. That's going from dependence to independence. They're struggling through that. But spiritually, that's what we're going to talk about today. They're really changing as well. And it's called something that we like to call in student ministries, we call it personalizing their faith. They're making their parents' faith their own faith. And you heard some of those stories in the testimonies that they talked about. There was one student, another great picture. I always like telling stories of my students. I love them. They're great. And this one student came to me on a Sunday morning and he asked, "Pastor Mark, do you have any money I could borrow?" And that happens all the time. And I don't bring money to church anymore, actually. But so he asked me if I had any money to borrow. I said, "Well, what happened?" He goes, "Well, I spent all my money at the Sugar Shack and I don't have bus fare to get home." And I'm thinking as an adult, well, this is a great teachable moment. Walk, right? But I was missing it. In my adult naivety, I was like, what? I was missing it because he said something very profound after that. He said, "You know what? This morning, my mom and dad and my brother, they're all sick at home and didn't want to go to church. But I wanted to go to my church. So I got up and I took the bus here myself." You know what? I almost missed it. That was a great example of a kid personalizing his faith. I loved it. I'm going to my church. His family gave him a day off card from church, and he chose not to. That is a big step in an adolescent personalizing their faith. That's a small step, and of course, as they get older and larger, more steps are taken. But they're moving from this parent's faith to their own faith. And through all the transitions and change, how do we help students build a faith that sticks? There's an epidemic across our nation that is happening, and it's crazy that kids graduate from their faith. What that means is after grade 12, they've gone through student ministries or through church, but after grade 12, they go off to college, they go other places, and they stop going to church. And the realities of the world hit them, and they're not plugged in anymore, and they drift away. Well, that is a travesty. And to me as a youth pastor, that is painful to hear. So what do we do to build a faith that helps them stick for the long haul? I believe God created two institutions to do that. One is the family that we are born into. The other is the church, the family that we are adopted into. Those two things, you know, we have to work together as families and the church because, you know, the task is too great for either one to do it on their own and to do it alone. We have to intentionally work together. And we have to help them answer three big questions. First of all, I was looking through Luke 2 one day doing my devotions. And I was reading the story of Jesus when he was an early adolescent. And it's the time when he was 12 years old and he ditched his parents. And they found him 3 days later in the temple talking to the teachers of the law. Right? You remember that. And by the way, parents, take heart because even You know, even Jesus, you know, caused storm and stress in his earthly family's life. So it happens to you too. It happened to Jesus' parents as well. But here in the end, in verse 52, it said this, and this is what kind of hit me. It says, "And Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man." You know, I'm a father, I've got two kids, and that verse impacted me greatly. It's funny how that happens, just a simple little verse that we read over all the time. It actually greatly impacted me. And I started to think about it and meditate about it, and I realized that that is exactly what I want for my kids. I want my kids to grow in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. I want my kids to know who they are, to know how they're created, to have a vibrant relationship with God and a vibrant relationships with other people. It brought me to seek to answer for my kids and for the youth that I work with three big questions, or even better, help them answer these three big questions. The first question is, who am I? And the key topic we're talking about there is identity. They need to find their identity. It says that Jesus grew in wisdom and in stature. He grew mentally and physically. And some of these different questions, sub-questions underneath the big question of who am I and identity are these. We have to answer, who am I as a Christian? Who am I as a follower of Jesus? How do I discern right from wrong? How has God created me as a man or as a woman? How has God gifted me? What does it mean to be a Christian? How am I different because I follow Jesus? Students who are forming their identity tend to try different roles and at different times end up compartmentalizing their faith into different parts of their life. And they'll live one way at church and they'll live a different way at school and they won't blend them and they won't see anything wrong with that. And we have to shatter that idea. It's almost like a student I had who had a nice necklace with a nice cross on his necklace. I thought, that's really nice. But then beside it, I noticed there's another pendant. And it was a pendant of a marijuana leaf. Well, those things just don't blend. Those two life purposes aren't the same. And this student was blending these two things and not seeing that there's that the Christ life kind of invades all of life and you can't live differently from one thing to another. You know, it's important that we help our students answer what it looks like to be a Christian and an athlete. What it means to be a Christian and an artist, a Christian and a musician. A Christian in real life, not just a Christian at church, a Christian at youth group, or a Christian at their private schools. But where being a Christian encompasses and infuses all aspects of their life. You know, what does a person of faith look like? What do they do? What do they believe? These are the types of questions that we have to help our students struggle through as they deal with their identity, the big question of who am I? The second question is this, how do I fit in? And the key word there you can write down is the word affinity. How do I fit in? Deals with affinity. And if you want a better word, or not better, but an easier word to remember, maybe right beside it, relationships. It says, Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature, and then it says, and in favor with God and man. You know, he grew relationally, spiritually with God in his relationship and with other people. My Bible tells me that I'm created by a loving, personal God who wants to be in relationship and fellowship with me and whose love never ends. What's it like to be in a relationship with a God like that? We have to answer that question. How do I communicate with God? How do I live to please God? What I like to call living to make God grin. Where do I fit in the church? How do I relate to my family, my friends? How do I relate to the opposite sex? How do I relate to the world around me as a Christian? How do I have a relationship with God that works and a relationship with other people that works? Those are the types of questions we have to help our students answer and work through as they deal with the issue of affinity. And the question of how do I fit in? Question three is how do I do it on my own? And that key word, you can write the word autonomy. Autonomy. And again, if you want a different word, is independence. This one helps our students solidify their faith for the long haul, moving from spoon-fed followers to self-feeding disciples. It's not good enough for us only to teach our children and youth about their identity and affinity without giving the tools that they need to live the life of faith on their own, being self-feeding disciples, able to discern right from wrong, able to discern God's will. In Hebrews 5, 12 to 14, Paul chastises his hearers for their lack of maturity in their faith. And he says this, "For though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the basic principles of the oracles of God. You need milk, not solid food. For everyone who lives on milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness, since he is a child. But solid food is for the mature, for those who have their powers of discernment trained. by constant practice to distinguish good from evil. At the heart of bringing up our youth is not only the transition from childhood to adulthood, but the transition from spiritual milk to solid food, from being a spoon-fed follower of Jesus to being a self-feeding disciple of Christ. You see, students, they can't answer all these questions on their own on the issues of identity and affinity and autonomy, but they need help. That's where the family and the church, both of us, have to team up. We're all in this together. We both have a part to play in the spiritual development of our youth. First of all, I'm going to talk to families. And families, you help students develop authentic faith by living the spiritual life as a family. In Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 9, there's a common passage I'd like to read to you. It says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might." I love that part. Just loving God with everything you have, your whole person. "And these words that I command to you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." This passage is commonly known as a Shema. And in it, God tells families how to best train up their children and youth. Their moral and biblical education was accomplished best, not in a formal teaching period, but when the parents, out of concern for their own souls and their lives, as well as their children's souls and lives, made God and His Word the natural topic of conversation that might occur naturally anywhere during the day. It's more than simply teaching about the life of faith, but modeling the life of faith and living the life of faith. It's do as I say and do as I do. They say for teenagers that more is caught than taught, and that students are always learning. The question is, as a family, what are we teaching? The Shema gave us four obvious and natural times where this informal education or real life learning can take place. And I want to talk about them a little bit in a modern day comparison. The first one is as you sit in your house. Translates, I believe, in our day to meal times. Meal times are some of the most beneficial times you can have as a family, but statistics are telling us that families are sitting and eating together less and less. There's something special about a regular and reliable shared meal. In fact, the experts on adolescent development who wax most emphatically about the value of family meals, well, it's because it's the teenage years that this daily investment pays some of its largest dividends. Studies show that the more often people eat together, families eat together, the less likely kids are to smoke, to drink, do drugs, get depressed, develop eating disorders, and consider suicide. And the more likely they are to do well in school, delay having sex, eat their vegetables, learn big words, and know which fork to use. We needed a study for that. Crazy. But it's amazing the impact of family meals together. The most probing study of family eating patterns was published by the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. And it took about a decade of information that they gathered. And what they got was this. They essentially found that family dinner gets better with practice. The less often a family eats together, the worse the experience is likely to be. The less healthy the food, and the more meager the talk. Brother Reggie Joyner, in his book, Think Orange, says that mealtimes are opportune times for discussion, with the parent's role being that of a teacher, and the purpose is establishing values. If you are one of those families where everyone is going everywhere to all sorts of activities, and you're never home alone together, and you're never sitting down for a regular meal, then I want to beg you to slow down and work really hard at finding some places and some spaces for shared meals. You will be happy that you did. Second one was as you walk by the way. Translates to travel times. I'm not talking about those long, hot, you know, stretched out car vacations where you're going to Disneyland or through the Grand Canyon, because too many of those might be detrimental to your family. What I'm talking about is just the things that happen every day. One of my most favorite times of the day is walking my kids to school. I love it. You know, each morning I use the time to encourage them, to pray for them, to ease their fears, remind them that God goes to school with them, and that they are never alone. It's a perfect time for informal dialogue where my role is more of an encouraging friend and we can interpret life together. You know, if you're a parent of teenagers, I'm pretty sure that you probably feel like a taxi cab company, just driving kids everywhere all over the GVRD. You know, I'm pretty sure of that. Well, I want to beg you, turn the radio off. Turn the iPad off, the iPod, the iWhatevers. Turn them off and chat together offline, live, face to face. You know what? It's impactful the time that you can share in a car. Some of the most, the best memories I have with some students are driving them home after events, and just the amount of time you can talk, and you know, you're forced to be together in a confined place, you're driving somewhere, and just, I don't know, it fosters this time where you can just talk and share stuff. And I've sat out front of probably many of your family's homes with their kids or whatever, just talking till for a long time. When you're together with your kids in the car, listen, talk, turn off the noise, and spend time together. Use those travel times for your own family's benefit. Next is when you lie down, translates to bedtimes. Another part of my favorite time when I'm able to, when I'm at home in the evenings, is I like putting my kids to sleep and tucking them in. It's amazing what kind of situations and emotions seem to bubble up at the end of the day right before bed. It's a time for intimate conversations, to reflect on the day's events, to actively listen to your kids as they share their heart. It's at this point the parent's role is more of a counselor, and the timing is right for building intimacy with your kids and praying with your kids. I know that as children grow older, bedtime looks a little different. You're going to put a teenager to bed a little differently than you do a toddler, right? I know that. But I still want to say it's important at any age that you check in, okay, with each other and give each other the time to reflect, talk, and debrief the day. And I bet that you'll sleep better as a family if you did that. My mom did something really kind of funny for me when I was growing up. And my brother and I, if we were ever out too late, you know, a little past our bedtime, or, you know, as we're older teens, or maybe past our curfew a little bit, we would come home and we'd sneak in the house. We'd try and get to our room, right? And I'd get to my room and I'd find my mom sleeping in my bed. She did that on numerous occasions. Why did she do that? Because she had a value of hers, was that she wanted to check in with us. And she wanted to know her kids were safe, know that everything was all right, and she wanted to say goodnight to us. So we had to wake her up to get into our own bed because I wasn't getting into bed with my dad. So that's how that went. But I can't tell you the messages of her doing that, how that impacted my brother and I. Messages of love, care, and concern. It was awesome. And I would encourage you to do that to your kids. It freaks them out. It's great. When you get up, translates to morning times. I am not a morning person. At Bible school in the dorms, they used to wake me up on purpose in the early hours of the morning just to see my face and how I'd react. And I was a bear. I'm really not that great in the mornings. But when I get warmed up and I get going, morning times are really important. You know, I love it because mornings represent a fresh start, a reboot, if you will. And I love it. It reminds me of Lamentations 3, 22 and 23, where it says, "The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness." Morning time is when your students and children need a coach with encouraging words, instilling, reminding them of their purpose. Mornings are pivotal because if you've had a bad start to the day, it usually taints the rest of your day. You know, it's important as you parent that you keep the communication lines open on multiple levels. We've just gone four basic times in the day, which opens up these communication lines on multiple levels, allowing for the natural sharing of values through living the life of faith together as a family. I told a story about my dad, or my mom, and I would tell a story about my dad. One of the greatest things he did for me as I was growing up is that he would spend time alone with me, just me and him. We would go out, you know, once a week, once every 2 weeks. It wasn't like a regimented thing, but it was often and regular. It was part of the pace of our life. And I am sure that I bored him to tears with my junior high babble sometimes, just talking and talking and talking. But you know, it's in those times that opened the door that when I had something on my heart, that I could ask my dad for his advice. I could bring up my issues that I needed care and concern for. It gave my dad the opportunity to speak truth and scripture into my life. And it was never, ever weird. It was never awkward. Why? Because it was part of our natural pace. I always knew I would have an open door. I'd have an open place to be able to share with my dad one of the greatest things he ever did. And I still, at my age, love to go out with my father. And it was never weird. It was never crazy because it was part of our natural pace. In a book called Soul Searching, Christian Smith ran a national study of youth and religion, and he published his findings. And do you know what the largest influence on a teenager's life was? Well, positively or negatively, it wasn't music, it wasn't media, it wasn't friends, it wasn't youth culture. Can you guess what it was? And again, we needed a study to tell us the obvious. It was parents. The number one influence on a kid's life, and I'm sorry, teenagers, you may not want your parents to know that, but that's what that study of thousands of youth and the largest study done of its kind came out with. Parents, the number one influence. See, statistics tell us that in most churches we have about 40 hours of influence in a child or student's life per year. That seems low to me as a youth pastor. I go, wow, but when you take out people going away for holidays or sporting events or other things, it's probably very accurate. Let's even say we double it. Let's say it's 80 hours of influence that we get to share in the lives of students. That's great. But when it's compared to how many hours a parent has of influence in the life of their child, they have 3,000 hours. It's amazing stuff. That is why parents, you are the number one influence and you are the number one spiritual leader in your home. It is not me. Excuse me. It is not the other youth pastors here at the church. It is not Pastor John. It is not Oprah. It is not whatever you want it to be. It is you. You are the number one spiritual leader in your home, and you have the greatest impact and influence on your teens, and that is how God has created it to be. The 3040 principle doesn't speak disparagingly against bringing your kids to church, but what it does tell me is that the church is in a support role for kids, parents, and families. We are not here to deauthorize parents, but to support the family. And parents, I don't want you to worry that it's all on your shoulders and feel a huge weight by what I'm saying. That's not my goal in this. Because it's not. It's not true. The church is here to help. You know, we're in this together. Again, we're all in this together. Paul, in writing to Titus on Crete, outlines for him a picture of this as he shares what should be taught to various groups. But as for you, teach what accords with sound doctrine. Older men are to be sober-minded, dignified, self-controlled, sound in faith, in love, and in steadfastness. Older women, likewise, are to be reverent in behavior, not slanderers or slaves to much wine. They're to teach what is good. And so train the young women to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled, pure, working at home, kind, and submissive to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be reviled. Likewise, urge younger men to be self-controlled. Show yourself in all respects to be a model of good works. And in your teaching, show integrity, dignity, and sound speech that cannot be condemned, so that an opponent may be put to shame, having nothing evil to say about us. Bondservants are to be submissive to their own masters in everything. They are to be well-pleasing, not argumentative, not pilfering, but showing all good faith, so that in everything they may adorn the doctrine of God, our Savior. In some versions, it says that to make the life of faith attractive, or to make God attractive through our faithful living. Did you pick up the support network in there? Titus didn't have to teach all these things on his own. He didn't have to do it all by himself. You see, the older men were teaching younger men. The older women were teaching younger women. Everyone invested in each other's lives, teaching, listening, learning together. You know, I talked about parents and families. Well, now I'm shifting to the church, talking to all of us. One of the key things we can do as a church is begin building a supportive scaffolding in the lives of our youth. A supportive scaffolding. Russian psychologist Lev Vygotsky introduced the idea of scaffolding as a necessary part of adolescent development. Just as in a building, when it's under construction, scaffolding is also crucial during child and adolescent development. Now, I'm not talking about the metal bars literally and things. I'm talking about people as a support network around those students as scaffolding. As teenagers mature and grow more independent and capable, the scaffolding can be reduced. As a support to the students and the family of our church, we can act as a supportive scaffolding needed. Research tells us that students need 5 adults who are intentionally caring for them in their lives at any given moment. Too often, they can only depend on a parent, possibly another family member, and if they're really fortunate, somebody outside of their family, like maybe a coach or someone who cares for them. What would it do in the life of our teens if we had at least two or three of those caring adults be from the church? I think it would revolutionize our youth ministries, our families, and the lives of the adolescents that we care for. You see, scaffolding surrounds our youth with mentors. I had a strong family growing up with lots of support. But along with that, I also had a large number of people who had the right to speak truth into my life. My oma, my opa, other family members, youth pastors, Sunday school teachers, and volunteer youth workers, some of which are still here attending the church and in leadership today, still being my mentors and models. We need to surround our youth with godly people who live the life of faith around them and speak truth into their lives. We need to surround our students, encouraging them on their journey. The church can provide mentors for your kids. Scaffolding surrounds our youth with sound doctrine. No one person can teach it or say it all. No one person can teach everything another person needs to know, but together we can do a better job than alone. I needed people to say the exact same things my parents were saying to me. And for some reason, when my parents said it to me, I heard it. But it took a couple more passes with other people sharing the same thing, maybe on different levels and in different ways, till I really digested it. I needed that. We need to surround our youth with people who are biblically on the same page. You see, scaffolding surrounds our youth with opportunities as well. I'm in ministry today because people saw in me what I could not see in myself and gave me opportunities to test and discern God's calling in my life. I had encouragement from my parents, but I also had encouragement from many, many other people. Each new person in the life of a teen opens up more opportunities based on their gifting and abilities. There are opportunities for service, missions, ministry, growth, evangelism. The more people we have forming scaffolding around our teens, the more opportunities they can have offered to them. And that's what we want. We want our students to test their gifts and abilities in living a life of faith. Scaffolding also surrounds our youth with prayer. I just want to say, if you can do nothing else, you can pray. You may not be a parent of a teen, but you probably have a teen in your extended family somewhere, like a niece or a nephew. Or a friend of the family has kids. Or there's probably teens somewhere in your life, and you can pray for them. And there are lots of teens here in our church that you can pray for as well. I love what Pastor Mark said earlier about taking the pictures of the baptism candidates, put them on your fridge or wherever, and pray for them this week. Pray for our teens. When it comes to the task of raising our teenagers, we're not in it alone. We're actually in it all together, both families and the church. I hope that relieves some of the pressure that parents are feeling when it comes to raising teenagers. I hope it builds security in the life of our youth to know that there are many people around them to support them. I hope it calls others of you to get up out of your seats and to get involved in building a scaffolding around students or get involved in our student ministries to make a difference by being a supportive scaffolding in the life of our teens and our families. On Sunday, April 29th, from 1 to 3 p.m., there's going to be a coffee and dessert student ministries informational meeting. And if you're feeling a tug in your heart, you feel that you want to get involved in student ministries, then come. Come to that and check it out. Just email me in advance. My email is in the bulletin. You can just let me know and come if you're interested. We need all types of people. I don't want to hear excuses. We need young people. You know what? We need, I'll call it experienced people or older people. We need you. No one is too old and no one is too young. As long as you're an adult, we can't have our youth being, adult leaders. But we need you there. We need all types. We need people who can teach the word. We need people who maybe don't feel as comfortable teaching the word, but they can love on kids and make them feel welcome and at home and greet them. We need people with gifts of service. We need people with gifts of music. We need all sorts of different people involved in student ministries. So if you're feeling that, just please come to that. Get involved. Our students are in desperate need of these role models, desperate need of scaffolding. Our families are in desperate need of support. And you can make a difference. I just want to let you know that. Just before I close with a verse, I just want to say that I really appreciate Willingdon Church for what they've stood for in my life. As I've grown up here at Willingdon Church, I grew up through the youth ministry years ago, and I had a strong family, and I had supportive scaffolding in my life, and what they've brought for me. I thank the leadership that allows us to hijack an entire weekend services for youth services and do baptisms here. And it's an amazing celebration. And I love the fact that they have a heart and a passion for their students and their youth. And they allow me to come and speak out of my passion. So thank you, church, for that. And in closing, there's a verse that's kind of my life verse as a youth pastor. I love it. And I thought it was good for us as a church in light of what we're talking about to maybe close off with this way. So this is kind of my benediction. This was Psalm 71, 17 to 18. And I'm reading it out of the New International Version. And it says this: "Since my youth, God, you have taught me. And to this day, I declare your marvelous deeds. Even when I'm old and gray, do not forsake me, my God, till I declare your power to the next generation, your mighty acts to all who are to come." Thank you very much.